You're listening to C101.5 FM. The Hawk is on the air.
You're listening to a show called Dangerfield on 101.5 The Hawk FM. I'm Mary, and tonight I'm joined by Jordan Zadorozny. He's a singer and songwriter known for his band Blinker the Star, who have released 10 albums to date. Their 11th album, called Arista, comes out on July 2nd of this year. Jordan has co-wrote songs with everyone from Courtney Love of the band Hole and has even had Lindsey Buckingham from the band Fleetwood Mac play on one of his albums. He owns an incredible studio in Pembroke, Ontario called Skylark Park, where he records and plays with bands both in person and remotely. I've known Jordan for close to 10 years, and he's one of my favorite people to talk music with. So welcome to the show, Jordan.
Thanks, Mary.
It's great to have you here. So let's start off the show with a song of yours called We Draw Lines off your 2012 album by the same name, and then we'll come back and we'll chat, okay?
Sounds great.
By Blinker the Star, and I'm joined tonight with Jordan Zadorozny, who's from that band. So Jordan, it's been a while since we've caught up, and I was just saying how before the song about how you're one of my favorite folks to talk music with, because you're pretty much music encyclopedia, I would have to say. And so where are you calling in from right now? Are you at your studio?
I am at the studio. Yeah, I'm in the control room, and It was like a ridiculously sticky day, so it's nice that the sun has gone down, and good to be talking to you.
Cool. And so your studio, the current one that you're in, is called Skylark Park. Is that correct?
Yeah, it is.
And so is that true that it's named after a little bit after your favorite XTC album, Skylarking?
Definitely, yeah. And it was our mutual acquaintance, Mike, who suggested it. I kind of just put it up in a Facebook post, like, what am I going to call this new studio? I don't want to. When I moved from the downtown studio, I had a place in downtown Pembroke that you saw and visited. And between that one and this one, I had to change it because it's so rural here. And so Mike had reminded me, you know, Skylark and Skylark Park and, you know, Paisley Park, because it's sort of a mix of like my big 80s inspirations, which were XTC and Prince. So
awesome. Have you ever been to Paisley Park?
No, I would love to, but I'm told that, like, you know, the outside is pretty, you know, industrial looking. It's really about being inside, but I think you can do tours now, can't you?
Yep, for sure.
Yeah, yeah.
And so you mentioned that you moved, you had a studio downtown. I think that was that called French Kiss Recordings? Is that what it was called?
Twas, yep.
And so what was that process like, first of all, designing a new studio? Because I think this studio that you're in currently, it was built from the ground up. And so first of all, maybe let's talk a little bit about what that process was like, kind of designing it, and starting from scratch and kind of having your own space to just kind of make perfect for yourself.
Sure, exactly. Well, you know, like there's obviously a limited budget to build a freestanding, you know, a building from scratch. And I looked at, you know, perhaps hiring one of these, you know, really talented acoustic treatment people. And it was out of my budget, you know, with the construction costs. So what I did is, like, I'm lucky enough to have had friends and peers that have kind of done similar things where they've, you know, built onto or built into their backyard or something like that. And so I called them up and I was like, I asked them, what was the biggest mistake you made?
And so I just
made sure not to make those mistakes. And then there's this book, I remember I found it on Amazon, like, you know, years ago before I moved into this place. And it's like this $100 duotang on Amazon. It's like this blue duotang that's about 70 pages long, but it's written in 1984. But apparently it is still like the sort of like construction manual for building your own studio. The materials have changed, but a good contractor, you know, knows how to translate the old materials into what's available now. And so I went with this like local contractor guy who was like, had never done anything like this, but was really enthusiastic and gung ho and like had a great spirit about him. So the tour, you know, I gave him that duotang and I was like, read it twice. Okay, please. Like, cause it's really important, this stuff. And he's like, yeah, man. Yeah, I'll do it. So that's how it got done. And so I built it like knowing the things that I missed in the old studio, and the things that I missed, it's almost like a negative process. This was because I worked in some really good studios in LA, but Studio B at like the place we worked at with Lindsey Buckingham, for example, that control room was so cramped because in the 70s, all the action was out in the control room. And now, you know, most of the action is in the control room. So my dimensions are different. It's like one third control room and two thirds live space, as opposed to like four, you know, five sixth live space and one sixth control room. So it's more functional in the way that records are recorded now, which is in the control room.
And did you have like a little model of the studio before you built it?
I wish, because I love miniatures and models, like miniature books. I would put miniature books on the walls of that thing if that ever got made. But yeah. No, I wish.
It's a good project.
It is.
So what was the process like of moving everything? Like, so you, like, yeah, you mentioned I was at your previous studio and it was, you know, it was like Candyland. It was just vinyls everywhere, instruments everywhere. Like what was that process like moving over to this place?
Well, it was like uncovering of a lot of cat hair in that old carpet. And you know, like by the time I moved all of the all the me stuff, all the vibey stuff, by the time I moved it out and put it on a big trailer, and took a look around the room, I was like, wow, this place is uninspiring. It's really just what you put into it. And, I didn't feel sad when I left the place because I knew I was coming out to a place that was like more where I kind of wanted to end up anyway, which is in a rural, like I love these rural studios you see mostly, well, everywhere, but like, you know, like the old Morin Heights or these places in Europe, a few I've been to, you know, they're gorgeous and the whole concept is great. I obviously, in fact, almost nobody can run these studios at their former capacity and luxury. You know, the budgets are just not that high. But mine, you know, I sort of aspire to like be like a miniature version of, you know, maybe the inside of Paisley Park and the outside of, say, Grouse Lodge in Ireland, you know. A miniature version of that and just keep it attainable. You know, the budgets are smaller, but that's kind of what I'm trying to do here.
And what was the first song that you played kind of like in your new space once you moved in, like full blast?
Yeah, so the big priority for me in building the live room is the drum sound, because the old place had really low drop ceilings, and I was only able to produce like a fairly dry drum sound, and I wanted versatility. So this new place is, you know, really designed for drums. And so the first day I was in here, you know, there was no paint yet, but I was already working. And I set up the drums in various places until I found the sweet spot. And I hit the snare drum and I was like, wow. It created a musical deja vu of a snare sound from the library in my head, you know? And it was Diana by Bryan Adams. And I was like, wow, it sounds exactly like Diana. And so I started playing Diana on the drums and I was so happy. I was like, this is the place for me. So that was it.
That's amazing. That's awesome. That's great. Sorry, that just stalled me for a sec. I was just picturing. That's hilarious. And so you mentioned drums, and so your brother was a drummer, or is a drummer. Your brother is a drummer, and
yeah.
So I met you actually through our mutual friend Dave Nugent, and your brother played drums with the Sam Roberts band, and you actually recorded that band, the album that kind of they hit it quite big with, Brother Down, was the song, I believe. Mm-hmm. And so you came from a musical family, and you had, your parents had a music store in Pembroke where you grew up. Is that correct?
That is. Yeah. Yeah.
And so what was the first instrument that you were drawn to growing up?
Well, before even being really drawn to it, I think my mom drew me to the piano. Mm-hmm. And she kind of started ear training with me immediately, like learning to recognize, you know, the patterns of common chord sequences and stuff, and being able to recognize them and replicate them and then play with them and stuff. So that was like the first education. And I was like two, I really was like just a baby. And, but my real, like, by the time I got to be like, you know, 6 years old, I was already starting to form my own sort of taste and identity musically. And I was into, you know, rock and roll, like early rock and roll, like Elvis and Buddy Holly and later the Beatles. And so then I wanted a guitar. And luckily my parents had the music store. So you know, I think the very first guitar, though, was my dad took like an old broken one and we painted it black and hung it on the clothesline. And that was like the first acoustic. I have pictures of that one. And the first electric. Yeah. The first electric was a company called a Winston. And it's like the ES-335 Chuck Berry body of a guitar. Mm-hmm. But all white, like John Lennon, you know? Okay. So that was the first electric guitar. And I remember trying to replicate the sound of I Love Rock and Roll. So that's about when I was 9 or 10. So getting onto those years. But yeah, guitar was the one that I had a visceral attraction to, is the answer to the question.
And what's your favorite guitar solo that you've played on any of your albums?
I would say a solo on the last album, which is from a song called Only to Run Wild. And it shows you how cuckoo I am. Like, I hummed the solo to my kids today, just not even telling them what it was.
Really?
And they were like, yeah. And they were like, yeah, there's the most theatrical thing. What is that?
No,
I thought it was like, I thought it was opera. And so I realized just at that moment, I was like, God, I think I like that one.
Well, let's listen to that.
Okay.
So you intro it then for us, okay?
Oh, okay. So this is a song off of the last album, Blink of a Star album, which was called Juvenile Universe. And it's called Only to Run Wild.
Yeah.
that was Only to Run Wild off the album Juvenile Universe by Blinker the Star. Tonight, I'm joined on 101.5 FM with Jordan Zadorozny from Blinker the Star. So, Jordan, you've got an album coming out on July 2nd, and it's a covers album. And so I recall that you had, I think it was on, was it on Draw's Lines that you had a Kate Bush cover Running Up the Hill?
That's it, yep.
And so I think that went over really, really well with folks. What prompted you to do an entire album recently? It's called Aristet, and you have artists such as, I think, The Stones that you cover. There's ZZ Top, there's Whitney Houston, there's Solange, there's a whole whack of people. So can you talk a little bit about how you selected the artists on the album and kind of what your thought process was behind the whole creation of it?
Yeah, so between albums, I usually take maybe a week or two or 3 weeks to sort of cleanse the musical palette and just kind of do something that I don't have a lot of emotional involvement in, like a cover, you know. Mm-hmm. You know, it's someone else's song. So it's like, it's kind of fun exercise. And I always learn something when I do these things. So so I think it was like, yeah, around Christmas time, I did a Pet Shop Boys song just for fun. And I was like, wow, that was fun. And was kind of maybe considering doing a couple covers, but not, I wasn't like committed to it. And then I saw I happened to see the Clive Davis documentary that was on one of the streaming services. And I watched that and, you know, I was kind of amazed at this character who had such a non-musical sort of upbringing and ended up being this sort of wizard of hits. Someone who could really just in his body feel what a hit was. And I kind of like came away, well, that, you know, that was my general impression of Clive Davis. But then at the end of the movie, or at least towards the end, they spent a lot of time on Whitney Houston. I was really moved by that and like her struggles and sort of the, how interesting their relationship was, Clive and Whitney. So I spend the evening watching that. I go to bed. And in my head, I'm sort of like digesting all this Clive-ness, you know? And I wake up the next day and I'm having a shower. And as I do sometimes, I'm sort of having like a waking daydream, imagining conversations that didn't take place or imagining a conversation that I'd like to take place. And I have this sort of like daydream of like Clive Davis signing me to Arista Records. And I can kind of picture it because I was signed to DreamWorks and I, you know, with Mo Austin and Lenny Worker in the room. So I know what that scenario kind of looks like. So I'm imagining it very easily in my head and it's me and Clive. And he says to me, he's like, all right, kid. He goes, you're all right. You know, you've been around and I like your studio skills and I like you have great production skills, but you've never had a hit. And he says this in the movie somewhere. He goes, hits are the lifeblood of the artist and you don't have any. So here's what we're going to do. I'm going to sign you to Arista. But like so many artists that he's signed and worked with, i.e. Santana, amongst many, he's going to pick all the songs like he did with Whitney. And I'm going to have to roll with it. And he's like, I'll pick the songs. You do your thing. I won't interfere with you in the studio. But you kind of don't interfere with my song picking process. So I kind of like used this imaginary Clive Davis in my head as the A&R person and guiding light as he would guide Whitney or Carlos Santana. And so the song choices are kind of all, you know, they're mine, but they're kind of like what I would imagine him. And the only one I thought, like there's only one indie rock cover on it. And that's the Land of Talk song. That represents me having a terse conversation with Clive where I throw a fit and I go, you got to give me one song. I really want to do this one. I mean, you know, it's a beautiful song. And he relents. So so that's the story of Arista.
That's amazing. I think you're going to have to actually act that out for the video. Minus the shower.
We'll be right back. time to celebrate. Just one day out of life.
What are your thoughts on kind of major labels right now?
Well, they don't really enter my my reality very often. Like, it's been a very long time since I got any sort of calls from major labels because they're not in the game of like rolling the dice on young, inspired. I mean, they're not in the game of like rolling the dice on like a rock and roll band or like something that's not straight up the middle groomed for top 40. So that's a different world now.
I had a bit of a great experience like with them, I would say.
I did. Yeah. And I would say that that may have been the tail end of the era of labels saying, that young
here's money, here's a budget, go have fun.
Yeah, like or the feeling of a corporation looking at a small little scene of people or a band and going, those kids are onto something, we don't know what it is, but it seems to be cool, so we're going to invest in it and throw a little money at it and see what happens. So I may have been 25 years old at the very end of that thing, that whole culture. And it was really great to be around, you know, just as I was around at just the very end of analog tape, you know, the very, very end of it being used in these big studios, you know, $3,500 a day. And I've learned so much in such a small period of time in those environments.
Was that investment in you liberating or constricting, did you find, coming from?
100% liberating, because I had I wouldn't say like I had a complete vision as a young person about what I would do in the studio, but I knew that that was the end goal, that the end all and be all of my dreams as a 17 or 18 year old was to be on a major label with a big budget, kind of calling the shots, being guided a bit by, at the time, you know, very wise and kind and thoughtful people at the labels. I met so many great people, and was guided, you know, thoughtfully by these people. They weren't just like messing around, you know. It was the end of that era, I would say.
And so you were already recording your own music before you got to that point. And so what was that kind of collaboration process like when you were then, you know, in another world where you're having to work with people with budgets and stuff? And like, did you find that, like, was it kind of like a mentoring thing where you learn from people, or was it hard to make collaborating work, or like, what was that process like?
I was like a very willing student, and I knew that there was a lot for me to learn. Like in my first meeting with my lawyer, Richard Grable, who was kind of like the kind of indie rock lawyer guy at the time. And we were lucky enough to retain him. And I remember my first meeting, I just kind of like, you know, I didn't know half of what he was talking about. And I just kind of just sat there. And at the end of the meeting, he said to me, in my manner, he just kind of says to us, he goes, "You're great because you don't talk when you have no idea what's going on. So you're going to be just fine." And I was like, oh, okay, cool. Maybe that's a good thing. But by the time I was like, you know, making major label albums, I had found a very, very sympathetic partner in Ken Andrews, who was the producer of the two major label albums that I made. And, you know, we were sort of co-conspirators at this time. He knew the label system much better than I do, and he knew the politics of it. And I knew that I didn't know, but I knew that those things existed. So I just sort of, I really watched a lot, and I put my foot down on things when I really, really felt strongly about things. Like, he wanted to go with early 16-bit digital technology to record August Everywhere, and we agreed that this was going to be an organic album. So I was like, no, we got to use tape on this. So things like that, you know, I knew when I was kind of right, but I definitely was already choosing battles, and that was all a very, very positive experience for me.
You've lived in many different cities. Do you write from always kind of like your mind and your imagination, or is where you are, does that seep into your stories and your music?
Both. I would say that the latter, like my place, you know, now that I'm out here in the country, I do spend a ridiculous amount of time staring at nature. And, you know, it's a lot. The old studio, my break place, if I walked outside, was either out the front door onto Main Street or out the back fire escape with a really loud, air conditioning unit from Pizza Pizza blaring. So when I walk out here, it's just like, okay, what animal can I hear in the distance? And how slow or how fast is that tree grown? And so I know that that's influencing me. I'm really not terribly interested in how, but I know that it is.
And do you ever sample the nature that's around you into your current songs?
Definitely, yeah, I have. And I actually want to get like one of those kind of fancy remote record, you know, those field recorders that are.
Yeah.
Yeah, those are so handy. But definitely, yeah, sometimes I'll take the time and like run a cable outside just to get a little something in there.
And when was the last time that you played a live show? So obviously COVID's been around for a while, but
yeah.
Do you enjoy playing live or do you prefer being in the studio?
You know, I've always been like, I mean, I love being in the studio. It's my dream, and I'm built my whole sort of life up to this point about having an autonomous zone where I can create, you know, almost anytime. So, but we played shows for the Careful With Your Magic album, which came out like around, I think, summer or fall of 2019. So we did a small run of shows. Tom Darcy, from Tom Darcy, he put the band together. I've always like, for me, it has to be good. It has to represent the albums in some way. It has, you know, that. I'm a real stickler for stuff now that I've been in the studio so long. So I hear mistakes so easily, and it's like, God, I can be a real pain in the ass of a band leader. But basically, I send an email to Tom in Toronto going, hey, do you have any idea? Blah, blah, blah. I don't know what to do. And within an hour, he had assembled a band for me of like the greatest, you know, it was the greatest unit. That was flexible. We worked fast and rehearsed fast and were ready fast. We only wanted to do 5 or 6 shows, or I only wanted to do that many shows. And they, you know, it was easy. These guys are all really busy dudes. So, but musically, you know, by show 3, I was like, wow, like if this band was opening for, you know, whoever on a 3-month tour, like we would be, you know, we would be really just firing on all cylinders after about a week. I could really feel it happening. So if those guys are willing, I'd love to do just a little, you know, Southern Ontario run again once things are kind of, you know, back to normal, maybe next year-ish.
Cool. Well, why don't we listen to a song off of Careful With Your Magic? Maybe listen to like Sweet Nothing, perhaps?
Sounds good.
Okay.
Thank you.
That was Sweet Nothing of Careful With Your Magic, a 2019 album by Blinker the Star. Jordan from Ben joins me tonight. So Jordan, I think I read recently that you work, so you mix and you master, you produce, you do everything, obviously. But you worked on a song that had Carol Pope involved?
I did. It was so fun.
Yes. Tell me a little bit about that.
So it's my great friend Bernard, who lives out in Almont, Ontario, and he has basically a project called Church of Trees, and he's had different vocalists over the years, and he's always come here to record the vocals with me, and then he leaves the mixing to me, which is always really fun. I love mixing. And so he got Carol Pope, and, you know, Bernard, you know, saw them, you know, in Ottawa in the late 70s. And like, he's a massive fan. And, you know, I'm Canadian and I grew up with much music. So I, you know, I remember the songs and the images. Yes. So what fun.
I saw her maybe two years ago.
Uh-huh.
She did a High School Confidential. I think it was at a fundraiser. I think it was for Hayden Dester's fundraiser that he does, I believe. And she
Very
was
cool.
She's incredible.
She's great. Yeah.
And so now with COVID happening, do you find that you are, so obviously people probably can't come to your studio. Is it making you kind of reach out more to other countries, other cities, can you talk a little bit about kind of your process for collaborating in other cities?
Well, yeah. Part of, you know, I would say this, like when I opened up my first studio, which was in 2001, you know, all of my work obviously was in person with bands, which is, you know, there's a camaraderie and a process that can't be duplicated in you know, and it's really fun too. It's also late, you know, it's exhausting as well. So, you know, in 2008, I remember 2007-ish or whatever, I remember like that was when we stopped FedExing data CDs to each other.
Ooh.
And we could do this over the internet overnight. Okay, I'll overnight you some stuff over the internet.
Right.
And you can do your guitar tracks. And it was like, whoa, whoa, whoa. And it really changed things overnight and accelerated just my business model into more of like a 70-30, like 70% live people coming to my studio 30. So since then, just pre-COVID, I would say that it's 70-30 the other way. And now COVID, it's 100%. So, which is fine though, because what that's allowed me to do is really, it's allowed me to make 3 Blink of the Star albums in a very, very short period of time. And that's been really gratifying and fun.
Yeah, you seem way more kind of like prolific in your own output a lot lately. Like you're just kind of banging out all the albums lately. So is that prompted by having kind of like, what prompts that?
I think about that because I've not had like a burst like this maybe ever. And, something kind of just clicked around the end of Careful With Your Magic, where I kind of, you know, I wouldn't say I was more confident, but I was basically, I found moving through the process of these songs a little easier for some reason.
Right.
And I found like a way of doing things that was a little more ragged and a little more, that was a little weird, but let's leave it. And it sped the process up and has made me like a little more reckless with the process, which I think is fun. and necessary when you're one person with the same gear, looking at the same view every day, just to really sort of allow a little bit of randomness and first take inspiration into the process. And at the same time, learning constantly, you know, that's always like part of it. But I think there was just like a new spirit of like, let's finish the damn thing. You know, like what's stopping this from, you know, like Aerosmith didn't worry about that stuff. Like, do it, finish it.
And how do you take in, so I recall you being, you know, a prolific reader about, you know, rock music, and how do you take in music now? Like, do you have, like, when you wake up in the morning, do you have, like a routine of, like, you know, websites that you check to read about music? Do you have books that you kind of, like, look forward to, authors writing? Like, what's your kind of process for taking in music that you're not creating?
Reading about music has almost stopped, like, as far as like discovering new stuff. I still buy music books, but I'm not looking, unless it sort of just shows up randomly, you know, in front of me.
Would you ever write a music book?
You know, the fear is that if I started, it would just never stop. Like, I don't know how to end. Like, I know how to end a song, but I don't know if I would know how to end a book. That's my big fear. I would have to, I'd really have to narrow it down to like a really sort of like ridiculously narrow subject.
That's fair.
Yeah.
So what would the subject be?
You know, like Def Leppard, maybe. I don't know. Like, it would really have to be like, it would have to be fun.
Yeah.
It would have to be something a little unexplored. Here's what it would be. It would be a book about, maybe I could do one of those 33 and a third books about, maybe someone already has though, about the Van Morrison album, Common One. Now, like, Van's off the deep end these days, and I don't endorse his shenanigans, but he's always been a little wackadoodle and has just kept it to himself. But there's this album I fell upon this year. I've had it for years, but it really just hit me. It's called Common One. And he did it with like Joni Mitchell's engineer, who's a genius, that French guy. And it's this, it's almost like the later Talk Talk records, where they sort of gave up rock and roll and they sort of like really, you know, made these beautiful sort of soundscapes. It's kind of like that, but 1980, you know?
Cool.
And so I could really write something about that, because it's really about the sounds and the music. Like, that's where the emotion, I mean, his voice, of course, is its own instrument, but
that's awesome.
Yeah, I could do that.
And what's your favorite music video that you've made of yourself?
Oh, the last one was really fun because we really mixed up the process. I mean, I would say videos aren't super close to my heart. Like, I sound like those like 70s artists coming into the 80s, and they're like, well, it's not really our thing, but we have to do it. they're just not.
Good measure, babe.
Once I kind of like had that sort of, you know, daydream in the shower, then I knew I took the whole process really seriously then. And I was like, this is going to happen. And I did the album methodically. So,
and how did here's you determine the order?
Exactly. So the song choice you asked about, which I didn't answer. Yeah. So song choice was sort of like kind of random at first, but what I found is that I abandoned a few things that I had started, which were things that I thought that would be kind of easy for me or like in my comfort zone. And you know what the thing I realized was, is that it was too much in my comfort zone. So things like Phil Collins, who I love and adore and really wanted a Phil Collins or Genesis song on the album. I become Phil too much. And it's too, like, you just rather listen to the Genesis version, right? So here's what I found is that I found it much easier to sing, say, an Annie Lennox or a Whitney Houston song where I have no business competing with her, and so I can't compete with her. Uh-huh. We do something so differently. So I have to change the key and I have to sing it a whole thing lower. And then it's so much easier to make my own. So towards the end of the process, I was actively seeking out female artists because I just found it so much easier and more creative because I didn't have that vocal, you know, similarity or competition happening with a male vocalist who's kind of like me, you know?
I love that.
Yeah, that was kind of the fun thing about it.
Started at a summer lake, a sentence and a name. If only for a moment's sake, held it down the loving heat longer than a lie. Held it down the loving heat softer than a child. We've seen how sick wind blows, but I've got you both thine eyes, and I love you. Body cries. We've seen how
to come.